So, you know, and he's like, if you're not being kept up at night by something, like if you're not really stewing on something and like really being challenged by something and like going through the highs and lows of it, the peaks and valleys of it, like you're not, you're like the last thing you want. Like if you think about a heartbeat, like a heart rate is like a flat line. You want those freaking peaks and valleys, and then to just turn every peak and valley into massive growth. And so.
I'm so excited for this conversation because my friend Tucker Max came on this podcast and he said to me, you know who you remind me of? My friend, Dr. Benjamin Hardy. And I was like, I know Dr. Benjamin Hardy from reading his stuff. That's really remarkable. And I think what he saw in me was a love for life, a curiosity, a general feeling of optimism and excitement, and I'm very honored and humbled to be put in the same sentence as you from that perspective.
Same. Seriously, I'm saying same. Tucker, he is an interesting guy. I would say he's one of my favorite coaches. I actually consider him a coach of mine. And a lot of people wouldn't think that way. But he, whenever I have a challenge, like a big challenge that I'm facing, I talk to Tucker and he just hits me straight in the face and in the heart. Like zero editing, just... And it's like exactly right. Recently, I was dabbling with two massively different directions for my career. And he was saying, and I've kind of been toggling both. And he said, good or great. He said, you can be good if you keep trying to do both. But if you want to be like great, you have to choose one. And it was just like straight up. And I was just like, I know you're right. I'm like, reminds me of one of my favorite quotes, which is, we're kept from our goal, not by obstacles, but by a clear path to a lesser goal. And so we're kept from our goals, not by the obstacles between us and the goal, but by a clear path to a lesser goal. And often we keep too many clear paths to lesser goals open. And it's just like, you got to like let those go if you want to go from good to great. And so we were deep diving that about 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
And he was not mincing words, which he does not do, which I love.
He just will tell us you straight how it is.
Yeah, just straight up. And he'll tell me, one thing he said to me, which was a huge compliment, is he said, you know, you are very open to coaching. You're very open to hearing the truth. You might not be ready for it, but you will hear it. Mm. He's like, a lot of people don't even want to hear it. He's like, you will hear it. You might not apply it yet. He's like, I've seen you apply a lot of things, but he's like, I know you can hear it. And he's like, that's an amazing step. And so I thought that was huge.
Okay, so this brings us to something that I really wanted to talk to you about when I was thinking about this, which is, how do you turn mentors into people that you work with and collaborate with?
It's a huge question. I love it. It's something that I've thought about deeply. I think certainly aligning goals. Thinking about the why from their perspective is huge, and how you can be a massive multiplier for them. Multiplier, one of my favorite recent books that I've read is called 80-20 Individual by Richard Koch, and he just talks about how certain people can create absurd upside, either for yourself or for other people. So I try to be that for certain people, but I know I can't be that for everyone. And so, you know, when I started writing books with Dan Sullivan, obviously, like, his work blew my mind. I thought it was innovative, and I thought I could contribute massively to what he was doing. But I also thought that it would be super exciting for me to do. And I in general, try to be that kind of person for a few people. Like, I can't do it for everyone. You know, and so just being selective about who you want to be that kind of person for. You love either what they're doing or what they're about. You really want to learn from them, but also you're willing to put your leverage, your talents, your energy, your time into giving them most of the results and being comfortable with that. And you knowing you're going to transform a lot of that way. So yeah, I think that one of the things I've learned about that as well is just how you approach the relationship. Mm. You can't be transactional. You can't be too quick about like, what's in it for me? You know, it's like you have to be genuinely interested in the long game. And that can be tough for people because we want to quickly progress ourselves. But if it's truly collaborative, one is you don't know exactly where it's going to go. You have to be open to that. Like collaboration, 1 + 1 = 3, but it might equal something totally different. And so you've got to be open to that transformation. Whereas I think some people are so short term that they just want to quickly get what they want out of it. And it becomes really obvious. And so for the people you want to collaborate with, they're just not going to be open to that kind of person.
And so to take it practical.
Totally.
What do you do with Dan Sullivan?
So with Dan Sullivan, I became aware of his work in 2014. My Aunt Jane is an entrepreneur. She has a health company, and she was really digging into his stuff. And she would just send me little Dan Sullivan quote books. Never heard of him, but I was very interested in entrepreneurship. I was actually studying entrepreneurship in my PhD program and like doing research on wannabe versus real entrepreneurs and just digging deep into it, and was getting ready to start my own company. But I started studying his stuff, and it blew my mind. And ultimately, I got into environments where he was, and I knew his work so in depth. And ultimately, like, I was listening to him give a presentation, and I was blown away. It was all on Who Not How, and it was the first time he'd ever like articulated it. And he just gave like a really semi-sketchy 15-minute presentation on it because it was such a brand new framework for him. But I was like, I think in terms of just like big ideas, viral ideas, and I was like, I want to see if I can take that as far as it can go. So I just told him that. I just said, look, if you ever want that to be a big idea, like not just a niche idea, if you want that to be big, I will write it and it will be huge for you and it'll be huge for Strategic Coach. And he already knew who I was. And so like he said, like, it just was like immediately it like rang true to him. Like it was just like, there was no resistance. He was just like, I know him. Like, and it was just very, it just like worked, you know. I just offered to just take what he did to the masses. And it was about him and his goals and his ideas, not about myself.
And what year was that in?
That was at the end of 2018. So that was like my first book, major book, Willpower Doesn't Work, had come out. I was working on Personality Isn't Permanent, which is another book. And that's where Tucker actually came into the equation, because my publisher, I was working on Personality Isn't Permanent with one of the major publishers, and they didn't know who Dan was because he's like this very niche character. And in the New York world, they want people who are famous. They want big names, big authors and stuff like that. And so they're just like, they just said, no, they're like, we can't do this book. Like, they're like, that would be a step back for you. You know? And I'm like, no, this is really cool stuff. But, so Tucker came in and introduced me to Hay House. And so like, I ultimately was at two publishers at the same time. And both books came out within 3 months of each other, Personality and then Who Not How. And I just ended up switching publishers entirely. But, It was messy. Dan honestly had to wait for about a year while I figured out the publishing situation, and I was also finishing school, and so he just sat and waited. We just developed a relationship, and I wanted to do it, and there was like a year where I was working on my other book and like trying to find a publisher, and he was just patient, honestly.
Well, I find this so interesting, is that you talk about you met him and connected with him strongly in 2018, and you started your writing online journey in 2015, mm-hmm. and that's 3 years of growth, of progress, and then you had the foundation for actually building the relationships with the people you aspired to be like or aspired to work with.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was 3 years, massive growth. I had a huge email list, had talent. I still had a long way to go as an author. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was betting on me as well. I had enough of an established track record as a blogger, but as an author, I was still very fresh. Yeah. And so I still had a long ways to go.
I want to take it back to 2010 when you first start saying to yourself, I want to write online someday. Yeah. But it's not until 5 years later that you actually go out there and put your words online. What happened in that 5-year time frame?
So I came home from my like 2-year humanitarian service church mission. And during those 5 years, I did my undergrad in psychology, got married, and ultimately ended up getting into the PhD program. And I would say that for me, my major focus was school and just like getting a foundation. I was a very bad student in high school, like had zero foundation. And so like I wanted to get some foundation, and I actually tried to write like 3 or 4 books in that time. Wow. Private books, wrote books on various topics, and like they were trash, and I just throw them away. It's like no one ever read them except for me. And I tried to write books during 2010 to 2015, but it was near the end of 2015 that I wrote like an ebook, Slipstream Time Hacking, wrote that. And then that's when I was like, it was actually when I got into the PhD program that my brain started really focusing on, okay, I'm ready to become a professional author. Before that, I think like my core focus was getting into the PhD program. And so like that was really absorbing my attention, my energy. But once I was in there, it was like, okay, now I've got time. Now I've got bandwidth. Like now I've got to figure out. And if I could go back, truly, I would have started sooner. Like, you know, that's, I think a lot of people have said that. And I'm not mad at my past self. That is what it is. But like, things would be different had I started 3 or 4 years earlier, which is totally fine, you know?
Okay, so there are people right now who are in that position. They know, they're listening to this podcast because they are saying to themselves.
They're thinking about it.
Yeah, they're thinking about it. And it sounds cool being an author or being something online or doing something that they know they should be doing. And they've been thinking about it for the past 2 years.
Totally.
What do you tell them?
I would say, like, set what I would call, I call it a keystone goal, which is the one goal that essentially, like, creates everything you want. For me, for a while, it was getting into the PhD program. The next keystone goal was get the six-figure book deal. That was such a seemingly impossible goal because I had no blog. I had no email list. I had no even website. I had zero online presence, and I want to get a six-figure book deal, which is like 1% of the 1%. But that was a keystone goal that really, you know, filtered my focus and helped me to, like, massively grow. And so, like, set a tangible goal. Like, one of the big things that I learned, and obviously if they're listening to this podcast, like, they're observing, they're watching, but they're also consuming. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you start to go on the other side of the curtain where you start to become a creator, you view it from a different lens. Not only do you view it purely as a consumer, but you're like, you're observing how it's being done. And that's really when I started to get serious, is I wanted to know, like, how do you become an author? How do you build an audience? How do you write books? Like, once I started to study the how and actually set a goal and start talking about it, started asking questions, started asking agents. And so what I would say to this person is, if you want to be a podcaster, if you want to start a business, like, actually, like, start figuring out the how, start talking to people about it and start putting things in place. And you go through the growth journey. I mean, that first ebook that I wrote it assuming I could go get a publisher because I didn't know the how. I then started talking to agents and they're like, you're a joke. Like, we don't even know who you are. I'm actually rewriting that book now.
Wow.
Yeah, it's called How to Stretch Time. So that's like what I'm writing right now.
Is that coming out in 2025?
2024.
Wow.
So that'll be fun.
And in that book, you slipped time. It was your first book and now it'll be your most recent book and it'll be a 10-year journey. Very cool.
Yeah, that'd be epic. So, I would just say, like, you're never ready, obviously, but your future self, you know, would be stoked if you started now. Like, I'll just give an example. Back in 2014 or 15, I started filming videos because I had watched people on YouTube filming, like, you know, like, self-development videos. And I actually filmed a few, and I filmed probably like 10 from my basement in my house at Clemson. I could hear my, like, 3 foster kids running around upstairs and me getting upset because I'm down in the basement and, like, looking up at them and, like, being mad because I've never filmed and stuff and, like, takes. But had I started YouTube back then, I'd probably be one of the biggest, you know what I mean? And it's okay. But this is about learning from your past experience. Like, this is a lot of how you master time is like, learn from your past self, but also let your future self inform you. So it's like, you know, how, you know, if I could go back and talk to that version of me, I'd be like, dude, just keep making videos and just start throwing them on YouTube and, you know, better prolific than perfect. But also, I think this is a huge aspect of what's called psychological flexibility. Psychological flexibility is like the linchpin of growth. And it's really about, like, I'm not my past self. My current self is extremely temporary. I don't need to defend my current self. I don't need to defend this conversation. Like, this is going to be an imperfect conversation. My future self will look at this and they'll be stoked about it because, you know, they're happy, but they'll be very different. And even a month from now, if you and I had this conversation, it'd be different. And so, like, just owning that flexibility and being comfortable learning. I mean, that's really what a growth mindset is.
Yeah, well, I think there's something important to point out of you filming the 10 videos but not putting them out.
Dude, huge.
What a lot of people are in that place right now of being scared of the judgment or scared of
I mean, it was me writing all those drafts, all those books and never putting them out too.
Yeah, what is that? And how do you get over that?
I think that, so identity, how I look at identity is it's two things. It's your story, the story that you live through, right? I call that the frame. So, like, you have a frame of reference or a frame that you're living out. So that's the story, but also it's the standards. And the standard is what you're most committed to. And the key part about, like, when you start fully, like, going towards your future self or living as your future self is not only the first part, which is mental creation. That's the imagination part, thinking about your future self, whether it's that, you know, running a company or whatever you want to be doing, seeing it. But the second part, which is most important, is getting so emotionally convicted about it. You got to get so emotionally convicted about it that, like, that's when it becomes a standard, because goals are not that powerful. They are powerful. But when it becomes a standard, it becomes the filter through which you make your decisions now. And so that's really what you want to do, is you want your future to determine what you're doing in the present. And so what you want to do is you want to get so emotionally excited about it and committed to it that you stop worrying about what people think about it. You stop worrying about the failure along the way. You stop worrying about what it's going to take to get there. It's like when the why is strong enough, you'll find the how, you know, and you'll find the who. And so you've got to get not only mentally clear on the vision, but emotionally, like it's got to become really important to you. That's like the why part. Like it's got to really matter so much that it almost, and this, there's a lot of research on this too. Like a lot of people, they put way more stock into the emotions of their current self rather, and they actually downplay the emotions of their future self. But if you can get hyper, you know, really excited and emotionally committed to your future self, it actually allows you to be a lot more flexible in the present, and your current emotions become a lot less like controlling. And that's really where psychological flexibility kicks in, is that, yeah, you might be scared. You might not know the answers. There might be a lot of uncertainty. You might even bomb, you know, like a lot of things. I bombed a lot of blog posts, like bombed that book launch of my first book and was depressed for months. It's okay though. Like that's part of mastering your past as well, as is that you transform every experience into benefits, into growth. And so I just think get super emotionally committed to your future self. You can always update it, always reframe it, but then it allows you to be very, very chill in the present, very flexible, and you can just start moving forward and learning.
This is such a difficult thing for me when I was going through your work, and when I think about just life in general. It's difficult because we are making decisions right now for a future self of ours whose goals and aspirations are different.
Yes.
And how do we reconcile that? How do we make good decisions when the 38-year-old version of me is so different and doesn't care about this podcast nearly as much as I care about it today, and cares about his children and cares about his wife, but I don't know my children. I don't know my wife. They sure. don't exist yet. So how can I make decisions for them? How can I make decisions for myself when maybe even at that time I'm divorced or, you know, something crazy? I hope not. But it's just like there's so many different versions of reality.
Sure.
And we don't know what ourselves are going to be like. So how do we make decisions for ourselves?
Well, I guess I'll ask you the question. How did the past version of you get here? Like, so call it 3 or 4 years ago or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
When that version of you was thinking about their future self, and obviously their picture of you is not exactly how things went, but how did that person make those decisions?
I looked to the past. I said, what was true when I was a child? Oh, I really liked reading. I really liked reading about growth and personal mindset and entrepreneurship and psychology. Okay, I still like that today. If I liked that when I was 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and I like that now, there's a good chance I'm probably going to like that in 15 years as well. I don't know if that is 100% true, but that was my best predictor for what I would enjoy 3 years from the time that I started the podcast.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I love that. I think that it's good to have kind of your best bet. So like I look at the past and I look at the future as a draft, right? So it's like the draft of an email or the draft of, you know, like you're write a speech, rip it, you can rewrite it. You know what I mean? And so it's a draft, but you still want to have something that you're operating off of, because that ends up being the filter for what you say yes and no to now. And so it's your best bet, but it's your best, you know, it's your best draft, but in the near future, it might change. You might have new information that totally blows that all away. And that's part of flexibility as well, is setting a new goal. And sometimes that's the best thing you can do, because then you don't have to be hooked on the assumptions of your past self. You know, just because your past self thought that was a good idea, you might have better information or totally shifted priorities based on either experiences you've had or just new information. And so I just think becoming willing and aware of that. I also think bring the goal shorter, right? So like, Your 3 year future self, who you are in 3 years from now, you can blow that up and think in major, really cool ways. You know, you can stretch it out and have it seem impossible to you, which I genuinely like think you should go for things that are impossible. But like, what are 3 years out isn't too far away. Things can look very different in your life. You can even have totally different views of the world, but you're close enough to that you can be pretty like clear on like what matters to you then. And you get to create your future self, by the way. You get to create your future self. And so if I think about where I want to be in 3 years, I can imagine it. I can think, where do I really want to be? You know, my kids are going to be 3 years older. Like I do want to keep writing books. I want those books to be better, but I also want it. And so I don't think it has to be that difficult. You know, like along the way, you keep learning, you keep growing. And it's okay to change your mind too.
Yeah. Well, it's always cool to reflect back on where you were at one point and see how far you've come. So I pulled up a January 2nd, 2016 journal entry that you wrote, and you said, "The clock doesn't stop. Only I do. I can't deny my excitement and anticipation for 2016. There is, without question, big stuff on the horizon. Hundreds of thousands of subscribers, well over $200,000, a book deal, weekly fasting on Sundays, and lots of prayers and journaling." I mean, that's pretty incredible when you look back at it, don't you think?
I don't even know where you found that, because I didn't even know that still existed. Is that an old Medium article or something?
Yeah, it's online. That's I wouldn't cool. pull that up if...
Yeah, you know. No, of course.
Yeah, but journaling is such an important practice, but particularly in the way of forecasting where you're going to go, because if you can do that, then you can have a sense for, okay, I'm January 2nd, 2017. Did this actually map to be true? Was this crazier than I imagined? Was this less than I imagined? And it gives you a good sense for where you're predicting you're going to go, because we're so often such poor predictors of our futures.
Yeah. I think that journaling is such a powerful tool for, I mean, it's a tool for me for clarity, right? It's a tool for me for functioning. So a lot of times people use a journal to document their history. For me, I use it for reframing and for refiltering my past, learning from my past, but also getting really clear on my future. And your attention, where you place your attention, really, really matters. What you focus on, you create more of. And so for me, journaling is a place to think about my future, to strategize about my future, to write it down. I mean, that was a point in time when I was very aggressive towards my goal of becoming a professional author, right? And so I like that I honestly made it public, because I was obviously not worried about what other people thought about me at that point in time, which to me showed me I was more committed to my future self than my present self, more committed to my future self than other people's opinions of my work. And so I like hearing that former version of myself and just seeing where they were at. So what ended up happening was, you know, certainly not all of those goals were achieved in 2016. By the end of 2016, so I guess I was writing that sometime end of 2015, thought I'd have like hundreds of thousands of email subscribers, X amount of money. A lot of those goals didn't happen in that year, now that I'm just honestly looking back at it for the first time hearing this. I ended up getting to about 100,000 email subscribers by the end of 2017, or end of 2016. And it was in January of 2017 that I negotiated the book deal for my first book. I did get help from like Ryan Holiday and others on the book proposal and stuff. That was probably my major goal. It wasn't probably till 2017 or even 2018 that I started actually making hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Wow.
But like, that was what I was going for. You know what I mean? And so it was kind of cool to just kind of see how it all worked out.
Yeah. What was that like? So I want to talk to you about two different things on that front.
Sure.
First is John Morrow's $197 headline course.
Yep.
Was you did it for 10 minutes and then you're like, I know what I need to do. And you just went. So you invested in yourself.
Sure.
And then with Ryan Holiday, you bought coaching with him to help him with the book proposal. So how has investing in yourself, particularly early on in your journey, helped you pay incredible dividends?
Yeah. I mean, if you have a massive goal, a massive filter, it's a lot easier to utilize the help of other people, especially if you're someone who, again, is more committed to your future self than your present self. A lot of times people are worried about, call it, making an investment in themselves, whether that's buying an online course, whether that's paying a decent amount of money for whether it be coaching or some form of direct help. You know, getting direct help is different from just listening to a podcast. It's very awesome. Like I'm a deep studier of podcasts. But when you buy someone's time and they're someone you respect, then you're like, and so you have to be the kind of person where even like you can't depend on them to get you the result. You know, like I know that even if, call it, I hire Ryan back in the day and it doesn't go well, like I'm not going to blame him for that. Like I'm going to learn from it. I'm going to just get the most out of it. And so you just have to have that growth mindset that what, you know, you're going to turn it into something massively huge no matter what. Like even if it's knowing what not to do. It's just kind of having that internal locus of control. And there's an internal locus of control or external locus of control. External is you let outside forces, you know, dictate what you do, whereas internal it's like I'm going to use this no matter what. I'm making this choice and I'm going to use it. And so yeah, I mean, I was extremely committed to learning how to blog in a very powerful way. That was the best resource I could find, the John Morrow thing. Went through like three or four modules and I was like, done. You know, I started just riffing it and I never even went back. I've actually been thinking about going back to that course, just honestly, just to like get back at better at writing. But yeah, so I just think you got to bet on yourself, obviously, at different levels, and just know that whatever's going to happen, you are going to turn into something good. Even if things don't go how you thought that they would, you're going to turn it into something awesome. And I just think generally having that mindset helps.
Well, this also circles back to what we were talking about at the start of the conversation, which you want to turn your mentors into friends, in some sense, support them. How do you support them? You buy what they're putting out into the world.
I also support Ryan in a huge way because I became a massive blogger on Medium, and I ended up managing his Medium account for like a year and a half and getting him tens and thousands of emails that he didn't have to do anything. Like we just did it for him because I wanted to help him back then. And so I just think trying to find ways where you can support the people that you want to develop relationships with in the way that you actually can. Don't try to support them in a way where you don't have like a skill set. But if you've got a skill set, or if you've got some form of like leverage, an audience, it's often worth it to do that. You won't always get something in return, and you shouldn't always expect that you'll get something in return. Sometimes people won't appreciate it. Sometimes it won't further the relationship. That's okay. Like, I think if there's certain people that you really resonate with and want to get connected to, if you can help them in powerful ways, it sometimes doesn't have to take a lot of your time, but it can potentially make a big upside for them or a big result for them. It's usually pretty wise to do it. I think over time you get better and better at filtering. You get better and better at, you know, I think it's still good to be generous. It's still very good to be thoughtful, but, you know, especially when you're just starting, like you've got more time, and you've got more energy, more excitement. And, over time you do get more and more thoughtful about the types of people you really want to like do a bigger impact for. Like, I think in the past I made a broad impact for a lot of people, and now I'd rather make a super deep impact for a few people.
Mm. Is that for readers of your books,
think it's just in general, the types of relationships I want to create. It's more about deep than shallow. I still, you know, want to impact lots of people with my writing. But I'm just thinking in terms of like relationships and even just in general, so as an example, like one of the things I learned writing the trilogy with Dan Sullivan is like, it made me think like, I don't want to just do like one-off books. Like if I end up doing even just a series myself, like I want to go, like, have you read any of Nassim Taleb's books?
Of course.
So like amazing. He did like his like four-part Incierto, right? And it's like, he went deep on like a set of ideas for like a decade, right? And so it's like, that's now how I think, is like, rather than just doing one thing here and then one thing over here and one thing over here and one thing over here, it's like, what's something I can just freaking go deep on? And if it's going to be with someone, like, I don't want to just do like a one-off project. It's like, how can I help them for like 3 or 4 years and like do something that's to the moon? And if I'm going to do something to myself, what's my own version of the Incerto? Like, what's my own thing that I just... You know, so I think that's just more how I think now is rather than, whereas more the blogger version of me was kind of happy to like be more broad, where it's like, now I'm cool, like going deep into this for years. And I want to freaking own this thing.
Well, this is interesting because it relates to Ryan Holiday as well, because Ryan Holiday has this series. Yep. And it also goes to 10x's.
Your ambitions get a lot bigger.
Yeah, in order to 10x, you often have to go deeper.
That is how.
And it is very difficult when you're staying at the surface level to really make the 10x, the impact 10x, your own understanding. And what I'm curious about though is the 10x. How do you 10x things that are difficult to measure? How do you 10x more love? How do you 10x more kindness? How do you 10x more giving? How do you 10x more presence? These are things that I was curious about.
Yeah. I think I look at things very holistically, right? And so I look at who I am as a person. I don't have to – I mean, I think it's nice to make things semi-measurable, although you can't – like that's what even a psychologist does, is they try to measure love. It's like, you know. And so obviously these things are qualitative, but you can actually – and I actually think that the real 10x is qualitative. What is the quality difference, right? Like what is the difference in this thing versus what it was before? So if I was to look at my relationship with my wife, it's like, what is the difference in quality? Like – of what it is versus where I was before, the depth of our relationship, the depth of our conversations, how much enjoyment we have together, like how much sense of accomplishment or sense of purpose. And if we actually think about where we're at in our life and just even if I just think about the conversation I had with her, you know, on my way here to spend some time with you, I'm like, how does that conversation in our relationship compare to where it was 3 or 4 years ago? I could write down tons of different bullet points, and those are ways I can measure the difference of a qualitative relationship. I can see it, but I also can define it, and that's a really important, I think, factor. It's an important thing, is rather than being defined by the past, you obviously want to define it, right? And so I get to define how my relationship with my wife is different. No one else really can, because it's my relationship with her. She also has a relationship with me, but she would be the one to define that. And obviously we can define things together. So I think you largely get to define what the difference is. And that's actually what you do to create your past. That's how you reframe it. That's how you refilter it, is I can define how I'm different from who I was last week. I get to look at it. I can think about how do I see the world differently than I did a week ago? You know, what choices are now available to me that weren't even on my past self's radar even a week ago. And by actually framing my past that way, and by filtering for that, I'm looking for the ways I'm different from my past self. I am now creating the ways I'm different from my past self. That's really what memory is. Memory is a recreation more than a retrieval. You always reconstruct the past from the present, but you do it from a perspective. You do it from an angle. And so I think when you're doing it with qualitative things, you're defining the quality difference. It's like when you eat two different types of foods, you say this one's better than that. Well, why? Then you start to define the differences, right? You're creating the differences, and you're defining the differences in quality.
That's fascinating. And so when you look at that and you ask yourself, like, I get to define it, but then some things you don't get to define. Some like
what?
Like a marathon, let's say. Like, you're running a marathon.
Very measurable, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, this is like, you ran a 4-hour marathon, or you ran a 3-hour, 30-minute marathon. Like, sure. There's a difference there. And I guess, how do you find peace even when you don't achieve certain outcomes?
I mean, I think that it's not really about the outcome. I mean, I'm a very goal-oriented person. For me, and I am very committed to certain goals, right? And it's that commitment that ultimately shapes the process. That's what deliberate practice is. I think having higher things that define you, having deeper things that define you, is obviously really huge. Identity, I mean, your identity is huge, but for me, it's also flexible. I mean, I think one thing is, and it fits with psychological flexibility, like, most of the goals I pursue, I don't hit, right? But you get to define what the past is. And so you get to define what the progress means. No one else does. Like, you can't tell me I was a failure because I didn't hit my goal. Like, I have to be the one to define it. And so because I'm the one who defines my past, if I define it in the negative, then I'm not going to get much benefit for it. Certainly, I can be honest about it. Okay, I could have – where are the ways I could have done better? Maybe in my preparation, in my process. But even that is making the past useful. You know, and you want your past to be useful. And so even by looking at it and being really honest about, you know, it's kind of like Tom Brady reviewing his tape, right? Maybe he doesn't win the Super Bowl, right? He can review his tape and he can look at the ways in which he's better. And as a result, it's still a success, right? It's still a valuable experience. And it's up to him to define what that experience is. It's up to him to define what it means. And I think taking ownership of that is crucial, and it's really between you and yourself. No one else has access to your own past.
Mm.
And so part of mastery of the future and part of mastery of the past is you continuously defining the past in ways that are beneficial and supportive of you, ways that help you improve in the future. You don't have to lie about it. You don't have to lie to yourself, but finding value in your experience, being honest about what happened. All progress starts by telling the truth and getting better rather than being bitter. You can't change the result by being mad at yourself. Instead, you do something about it. You approach it. You learn from it. And then you make new decisions as a result.
What comes to mind for me is what I'm studying from Dr. Michael Gervais right now about how when the Seahawks played the Broncos in the Super Bowl, the Broncos said in the media before, oh my God, this is the biggest game of our life. This is going to be crazy. And the Seahawks, who Dr. Gervais was helping coach in some way, said, we're looking at this as just another day to achieve excellence. And that difference of, in one sense, you think it's the biggest moment of your life. They're defining it as the biggest moment. Another group of players is defining it as, this is another day at the office where we're going to do what we set out to do, because it was a Super Bowl practice and it was a Super Bowl summer, and every single moment is a Super Bowl. That creates a different framing because you define it differently, as you said.
Yeah. I mean, it fits with what Dr. Daniel in a very different way. And from a very different lens, what Dr. Daniel Gilbert said, and he's a Harvard psychologist who studied this, he says, who you are in the present moment is as fleeting as the present moment. Mm. And so for me, everything is an opportunity to just practice, transform, to grow. Am I committed to things going well? Yes. But am I going to look back and am I going to learn from everything? Yes. And so for me, I do love that difference, like not overly inflating, you know, what this has to mean, but instead just continuously approaching it from honestly like a mastery perspective, a learning perspective, a growth perspective, and then just taking it, learning from it, getting better, and then doing the next one. And I just think it becomes a lot funner. I mean, I just, as an example, honestly, just doing like in-person podcasts like this, I approach it very much like practice, like just genuinely. I want to have a freaking awesome conversation with you. If we had the conversation a year from now, it would probably be better. But like, this is awesome. It's practice. I'm going to learn from it. I can get some feedback. We can talk after. Hopefully it's awesome for your audience. But then move forward and let it go. I mean, that's a big part of it, is letting go of what it means. Mm. Like even if say for some reason I get the sense that it could have been better, right? That's just one view. That's me being defined by it, right? And I can say it could have been better, but ultimately, even tomorrow, if I'm journaling and reflecting on this, I can look at all the ways in which I got something out of that experience and that I learned from it. And so it's just really being a learner of your own experience and then just becoming better in the process. That's me being different from my past self. So I just think it's just continuous learning and practice. And I think over time, and it fits again back with psychological flexibility, just not being attached. You, like that's the big aspect, is not being attached to what any one thing means and having it be defined a certain way. I don't have to have it be defined a certain way. I get to redefine it over and over and over again. So I'm never defined by what this conversation is. I'm the one in the future who's going to define it. And I'm going to define it in ways that are going to empower my future self. And so it's just being the one in control, locus of control, being the one who controls the narrative. It's your own narrative. That's identity. It's the story. It's the frame. It's the filter. And so that really makes you flexible. Like, even if your opinion of this conversation is terrible, I can't control that. Like, I'm the one who's got to control the frame and the filter of my own experience. And I better do it in a way that's going to empower my present and my future self, or else I'm just shooting myself in the foot.
So how does this relate to you being 16 years old and crashing a car on the highway?
Yeah, good point. So I was a 16-year-old boy, and I'll tell you how it relates to that story and how it relates to something just as personal that happened last week. But in that story, I had just gotten a driver's license. We were driving up with my mom and my two younger brothers. Sorry, driving up to Sun Valley, Idaho to visit a friend. And ultimately we ended up getting in a crazy car crash, right? I was the driver. My mom was sleeping in the back of the car. She was taking a rest. She got thrown from the car. She wasn't wearing a seatbelt. And, you know, I got knocked unconscious. And so there's a few things that happened. One is that my mom ended up getting taken to we were out in the middle of nowhere in Idaho on some two-way highway. And so, yeah, she got taken away. Me and my younger brothers got taken in an ambulance to some hospital. I'm laying on the bed. A police officer comes in and he helped me reframe it. This is really huge. And usually it does take having someone. I mean, you can get really good at reframing on your own, but often it takes getting someone else to help you. And that's what Dr. Peter Levine would call the empathetic witness, right? That trauma is not what you hold inside. Trauma is not what happens to you. It's what you hold inside in the absence of an empathetic witness. Mm. So anyways, what happened was we got in a car crash, flipped multiple times. My mom is thrown 50 feet from the car. And we're sitting there staring at our mom, ragdolled 50 feet. And she's just like, I mean, it's, you know, and I was already, we were already all messed up. You know, like my dad was, you know, in a rough patch of addiction, very destabilized. And so this was rough. So we are taken to a hospital in an ambulance, and I'm laying on a bed, and a police officer comes in and says, which one of you is Ben? I said, me. So I get up and I'm walking towards him. I look at my pillow and there's a pile of hair. And he says, you're in shock. Your hair's falling out. This is normal. Seriously, my pillow was covered in my own hair. And he's just like, you're in shock, dude. Your hair's falling out. And I was totally in a pure shock state. But he told me the situation. He told me what had happened was there was a construction site and there was construction cones between the two lanes. And ultimately, there was 150 yards of missing construction barriers. And when I was driving, I went to get over, and there was no road. So I yanked the wheel back, and it was raining, so it was wet. And we started spinning, flipped, crashed. My mom went flying. But he told me that the person who was supposed to come and look at the construction site didn't show up that night. And so, like, there were 150 yards of construction barriers that had been knocked over by a truck. And the person who was supposed to come and look at it... just didn't show up, and so there was missing construction barriers, and so that's what caused the crash to some degree. So he helped me really firstly define the experience rather than being defined by it. He said he told me it wasn't my fault, that this was someone else's. Not, I mean, you can't really blame someone else, like, but he just helped me understand that it's not my fault. And he just said, you know, you're the older brother of three kids. You have to decide what this means. This could totally, like, jack you up. This could mess you up. He's like, I don't know if your mom's alive or not. And she might not make it, but, like, you have to decide what you're going to do. And so that was huge. And I think that ultimately what he taught me was that I had to define the experience and I had to decide what I'm going to do from it rather than being defined by it. I've got to define it. No matter what, even if my mom did die, is this something that is something I can use, or is this something that's going to use me? Is my past going to determine me, or am I going to determine my past? Is this going to happen for me or to me? Am I going to be more fragile, or am I going to become anti-fragile, right? It's just like, it's all these analogies, but it was huge for me. The amount of time it takes to emotionally, what I would say, recover from an event, which is really where you reframe it in a positive way, that is called a refractory period. So the longer you hold on to the initial experience and the initial frame of the experience, the initial story, the longer you're stuck. And so part of becoming psychologically flexible is being open to a new story, a new frame. So this is where I'll tell you kind of the more recent one. So I was on a fairly big podcast, and I told the story in that podcast of I mentioned my dad being a drug addict. And that podcast came out, and it was huge. You know, it got listened to by tons of people, hundreds of thousands of people. And I was talking to my mom about it after, and she's like, you did so good in that. But she's like, honestly, she's like, I think you should be a lot more thoughtful about how you talk about your dad. And I realized that she was right. And this is, again, part of you're not your past self, but also your present self is fleeting. And that reframing means, a big part of reframing means that yes, you respect the view of your past self, but you also acknowledge that their view was limited. And that their story may not be the best story to tell anymore, or at least not the most useful angle of it. And that there are maybe better angles, more powerful, more empowering angles. And so I realized that I needed to change that narrative. And so rather than my dad being the drug addict, actually it's my dad being my hero, which is actually extremely true. Wow. My dad is my hero. And largely it's because of what he went through and the fact that, yes, he actually did overcome many of his addictions, if not, you know, like, we all have our own challenges in the present, but he's not the same person he was in the past. He and I have, you know, we're like best friends. And so I had to think about that. And, you know, I remember this was just like last week. And I just remember feeling super bummed. Not bummed. And again, I'm not bummed by what I said. I'm not trying to change it. But I think part of reframing is detaching from needing to be right. Acknowledging that maybe I had it wrong. And just being willing to face that. And then quickly move on. Like, and so I immediately texted my dad and just told him the situation, told him I'm sorry, told him I'm gonna approach it very differently. And that was my way of reframing it. And then thinking about what's a better way of talking about this, and then just moving on and just letting it go and just making the refractory period 20 minutes rather than letting it throw me off for a week, right? It's just like, I can tell a much better story. There's a way better way of doing that. Yes, I didn't handle that the best. It's okay. I'm not mad at my past self. I'm not sad I let it go. I'll still promote it. Like, I want it to go well. But I now acknowledge that I could have looked at it better. And I will look at it better now. And I'm stoked on that. I don't need to to hold on to that. I don't need to defend it either. I don't need to defend my past self. I don't need to defend my current self. I'll just be freaking open. I'm going to learn. And man, it's really about becoming stretchy, you know, like, you know, that ability to withstand new ideas or new insights and not like clinching back, but just being freaking open to it. I mean, just hearing it, listening, recognizing, and readdressing.
That's clearly one of your superpowers.
I don't know. It's something I'm working on.
Well, Tucker Max commented on it, and you were able to do that in that moment with your mom. And it is such a heartwarming experience when you give someone a piece of feedback and they say, oh, you know what? You're right. Or I could see the ways in which you're right. That is such a different experience, which gives you more feedback, which allows you to grow more than the one where the person's like, you're not right. What the hell is wrong with you? And gets on the defensive. So the question becomes, how do you help people be more open to the feedback that they receive?
Yeah, I mean, that version that you're talking about is the natural reaction. You wanted to get defensive, you know, and I think that just a big step is acknowledging I'm not my past self. Like, I'm not even the guy 2 weeks ago who filmed that podcast. And also just you know, just knowing that, I guess it's just rather than trying to be right, trying to get it right, you know, as Brené Brown would say. And so I just love that insight and just knowing that I can change. And so sometimes it takes massive exposure. You have to expose yourself. Like I had to be exposed to the idea in my head directly. I mean, that's what stops people from growing is that they don't even want to expose themselves to their own maybe weaknesses or miss, you know, wrong ways of doing things. And by wrong ways, I'm just saying like, you now have a better view. And so I think that being willing to be wrong. I mean, there's a really good book called It's Not How Good You Are, It's How Good You Want to Be. Have you ever heard of that book? By Paul Arden. And one of the things he just said is something along the lines of, like, it's better to be, you know, like, rather than trying to be wrong, like, or rather than trying to be right, actually, like, recognize where you're wrong, you know? And over time, you just move on so much quicker. Like, if I had to defend myself, then I'd be holding on to it. I'd be thinking about it. I'd be clenching myself. Like, and that's dogmatic. Like, I don't need to defend that. And so I just think that you actually overcome things so much faster by transforming them. So yeah, in the short term, you've got to go through some psychological stretching, some emotional stretching. You got to feel it and face it. I felt super bummed for about a day, you know? But I mean, I acknowledged it very quickly, moved on, and now it's like something that we're talking about and turning into even more benefits, right? Like, and so it's like you get so much more benefit, and you get so much faster at just turning something into a positive, and then just moving on, and like that's one of the keys is now I can move on. Like I don't need to worry about that. I can just move on and think about other things and grow in other ways. Whereas if I had to keep defending that or, you know, whatever it is from Tucker, from someone else, then I'm like I'm forcing that to be true. I'm attached to it. And now like I can't even be open to anything new in the future. And so I just think it's so much more worth it. And you don't want to avoid those experiences. You don't want to avoid the emotional depth. Sometimes going through deep emotions and, you know, going really deep into the sorrow, but into the joy. And yeah, I just think that's part of life. I mean, I forgot where I was listening to it. I was listening to something and just actually I grew up skateboarding. So I was like very into skateboarding and I was listening to this interview with one of my favorite skaters and he was talking about this 3-year period of time where he was filming a skate part. So in skateboarding, like for me, I might spend a few years writing a book. For a skateboarder, they're trying to film a skate part, which is usually like 5 minutes of just them just freaking rocking out epic tricks. And it's the skate part that they're trying to do. Like that's like their legacy in a way as a skateboarder. And so he was talking about trying to do this, like create this skate part for like, you know, 3 years. And there was a trick that he had destroyed his knee on and like ruptured his ACL and stuff. And so he had to like, he couldn't skate and he came back and tried it. And he said he was haunted by that trick for 3 years. It was like keeping him up at night and stuff. And like he ended up landing it, you know, and like it was like the ender of his part. But he was just talking about those 3 years of just like battling that thing. And the guy who was interviewing him said, dude, that's living. Like, so, you know, and he's like, if you're not being kept up at night by something, like if you're not really stewing on something and like really being challenged by something and like going through the highs and lows of it, the peaks and valleys of it, like, you're not. You're like the last thing you want, like, if you think about a heartbeat, like, a heart rate is like a flat line. You want those freaking peaks and valleys. And then to just turn every peak and valley into massive growth. And so, you know, I just think it's worth it to get flexible enough to deal with the emotions of massive growth and of accepting that you're, you know, you do things differently than your past self, and of being acknowledging where you could do things differently now. Just that openness really, really just creates massive growth. And I like the phases where I'm really trying to solve something and it's keeping me up at night. Like when I'm writing a book, my wife hates it because there's like a 6-month section where it's just like, dude, like it almost looks unhealthy. You know what I mean? But like, I'm so grateful for those episodes, you know, those transform me so much.
What's the current place in your life that represents that one trick that you're trying to land?
That's a really good question. I actually think it's parenting right now. I've got 3 teenagers and I'm bombing that trick. Like, I've, you know, the cool part about skateboarding is watching someone try the same trick, like literally like 100 times. And it's just and eventually they stick it. You know what I mean? And then eventually they get so good that they can like do it every time. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, with that is so challenging. You know, our older 3, we adopted from the foster system. They come with their own challenges. And I have to acknowledge every day that I could, like, I didn't approach that the best way. You know, like, you know, in certain conversations, like, it's not like I'm constantly, like, critiquing my efforts. Like, I mean, a lot of it's just the holistic, like, genuineness of the connection. But, yeah, I mean, I'm seeing that as an idea, I've been a lot more critical than curious, right? I've been a lot more avoid-oriented than approach-oriented, like trying to help them avoid things based on my own fears about their future rather than like really like just developing an amazing relationship, which we have. But yeah, I mean, that's probably the most meaningful thing in this context right now that I'm working on. I mean, I certainly, you know, have other pursuits, my books that I'm really trying to dial and stuff like that. But yeah, the parenting one, like that's the trick I'm working on, and it is keeping me up at night in good ways.
Well, in what ways could you become a better parent?
Such a good question. So like I'll give an example with my son Caleb, 15 years old. I think I'm really trying to learn how to help him trust me, you know, and not needing to overly inflate. You know, it goes back to future self versus present self. Often when we're in a fearful state or something, we blow up the emotions of our current self, and that would come out in the form of overreacting, right? And so I think I overreact to certain things and I catastrophize and stuff like that. And I think letting that go, not letting it go, but like playing more of the long game. Like, you know, one thing I'm learning and working on right now is focusing on what you want to create more of. It's selective attention, you know, like rather than focusing on the gap, like see the gain, right, as one example, but also like focus in the direction you want things to go, not in the direction you don't want things to go. That's the difference between avoiding something you don't want versus approaching something you do. And so, I mean, so many things, man. It's complex. It's challenging to be a parent, but I think it's good. It's that idea of that skateboarder being up at night for something that they might not think that they can do, like actually pursuing something that might feel impossible and working on it. And it sometimes feels like I'm swimming in water that's like it might be too deep, you know. But I'm stoked. I'm learning how to swim in that water. And so, I mean, I love it. And honestly, another thing that I'm working on is just truly enjoying it more. Mm. Like, and that's of all phases, like even in my work, like literally just enjoying it, truly like seeing it for what it is, you know, insane gratitude, insane appreciation, like just loving if I can work on a chapter, like, you know what I mean? Like just freaking loving it. You know, loving that I'm in the situation where I can try to help him in this situation, you know, and just being a positive influence.
It's so interesting to me to hear someone like you think about the struggles of being a parent, because I know that you have been a parent to so many people who you've never met, and you've given them the advice, and they haven't had parents to lean on. So they've opened up your books or read your articles, and that is how they are making sense of the world. And when you frame it like that, and to understand also that you have your own struggles, and that even though you've done it so well for so many people, it still is a challenge when you're live in the arena with that person or with those six people. So I guess the question becomes, what would future you, what would you 10 years from now, what would the advice they would give you to grow as a parent?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things. Definitely more love, you know, way more love, positive interactions. I mean, there's plenty, there's lots, you know, but like, that's the main thing that stands out is just like really create more moments, and just a lot more love, a lot more encouragement, a lot less critiquing. And that goes for myself too, you know. I think often in our own world, it can be easy to critique, right? But it's just like encouragement is huge. And so, yeah. And I honestly think my future self would also tell me, like, dude, like, just look at the situation. Like, you're actually doing enormously better than you think. Like, actually appreciate the situation again, you know? Like, and so, I mean, I'm sure they would say plenty of things.
What's the difference between raising adopted children versus biological children?
It's probably different for everyone. I'm really glad we had our three adopted ones before, because then when our little ones were born, like, they already had. The little ones are only like 4 and 2 and like almost 5 and 3, but like they don't even know that those kids are adopted, and they don't even know what that means yet, you know. But like, wow. So their reference frame is just, you know, these three are and I want and I love that. I love that, just like that they are part of the family rather than sometimes no situation's perfect, but I'm glad that that turned out for us. I think that one challenge, at least for me, and again, it's different for everyone, is when we were foster parents, we didn't know if we were going to be able to adopt our three kids. And one of the things that often foster parents do is that they try to keep some emotional distance for their own sake, right? Because they don't want the heartbreak if the kids get taken away. And it is heartbreaking. One of my dear friends had three kids, and they had them for 2 years and were fully committed to adopting them. And those kids got taken back to their mom, and it was like a non-ideal situation, but it was what it was. And like, their hearts were broken. But they have to choose how they define that, right? And those people are very good at defining everything in a powerful way, that it happened for them, not to them, and just that things will work out. But me and my wife ultimately decided, because we weren't sure if we were ever even going to be able to have our own kids, was we are going to commit to these kids even if it destroys our hearts, you know, even if it breaks our hearts, just because we wanted to give them that. We wanted to give them at least one experience, even if they had to go back or go somewhere else. We wanted to at least have them have one reference point where someone really like fully brought them in. And so we tried our best for that. And we were willing, again, to expose ourselves fully to the ramifications on the other side. And I think that fits actually a lot with committing to your future self, is exposing yourself to the ramifications and being okay on the other side. So, yeah, I think one other challenge, and I think, at least for me, again, everyone, you ask anyone, it'll probably be different, is a lot of it's I have to choose it. Like, I think when it's your own kid, like, you really don't, like, question. Like, I mean, you probably have to still choose to love them and not, like, and also, like, these little kids, we're not dealing with the same problems. And I'm sure when they're teenagers, we'll have to figure that out. But like, at least with the older three kids, like, I feel like I have to, like, I had to choose to like commit to them. Mm. Whereas when it's your own child, like, you kind of, I think typically you're already like, you're already committed, like for one reason or another. Maybe that's not true of all people, but for me, it's just like, you know, my kids, like with these three, it was like, I had to choose it. Mm. I had to choose to be. And for that, I would argue it comes with so many different benefits. Because it's like, I'm proactively choosing to be their dad. And like, they also have to choose to say, he's my dad. Whereas like, they also have a biological dad. And so like, you have to almost choose that identity, you know? Like, you have to choose the story, the frame, where, you know? And so, those older three are huge. I'm the beneficiary. They're my teacher. Mm. More than I'm their teacher. Like, what you're talking about, me being a dad to a lot of people, like, I first off, I don't even feel that way, but I'm grateful you say that. But a lot of the lessons I'm learning are from these three kids. And wow. So like they're actually the ones forcing me to grow in so many ways, or inviting me to, which hopefully is a benefit to other people.
It's interesting when you say you have to choose them and they have to choose you. One concept that I've been thinking a lot about recently is like, would you choose your circumstances if you knew it today? And obviously it's different with parenting and raising children. You're like making a commitment to like raise this child for 18 years or more. But choosing circumstances as it relates to career or relationships or friendships, right? Choosing that is like, we often don't think about while we're in it, if we're 3 years into a relationship or 5 years into a career. Would I choose this career today if I was just starting out? I was on day zero, but I knew everything I knew. Some people wouldn't, but they're going to still be in it for another 5, 10, 15, 20 years. So,
yeah, I think it's some things you would and some things you wouldn't, you know, and kind of deciding what really matters to you. When it comes to my kids, I'll choose it. And I value that above even my work, right? And so, like, even if I had to choose that over my work, right? Like, and there's other things where it's like, no, like, if I was at ground zero, like, I'm out. Like, I wouldn't choose it. I would choose something different, and I will now, you know? And so I think it's dependent on various things.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I want to talk to you about was God, because Tucker said that you were the first person or one of the first people to help him understand God in a new way.
Did he say in what way, or did he just...
I believe this interview was, I don't know, 6 to 12 months ago, but I believe what he said was he didn't understand like knowing God versus feeling God. Hmm. And you said to him something about feeling God, and that was impactful, and he understood it better after hearing that. So in what ways does God, faith, play in your life today, and how has that manifested in some of your work?
Huge. I think that a few ways I look at it is like, I definitely believe in God, but feeling God is huge. I mean, prayer is such a big part of my life. Praying for whether it be success, right? Praying for help, praying to figure something out, praying for other people. I find so much power in it. But also, like, the idea of feeling God, like, I do viscerally, like, feel spiritual experiences regularly. You know, even if I'm just, like, out walking, like, if I'm just meditating or thinking on things, like, I just feel a very, you know, potent power that I attribute to God. And, I mean, I just want to tap into that, you know, as much as I can. And so, like, yeah, God is a big part of my life. It's a big part of my framework for how I think of reality and how I operate, and trying to open myself as much to that as possible and being expanded by it. I feel like I've learned and I'm learning to have a healthy relationship with God. And what I mean by that is my belief on it is that I have large choice in what I do. But at the same time, I'm open to that choice being altered, you know, like with better information or with insight. And so, yeah, I feel very flexible. I feel like God is very flexible with me. And sometimes I'll get deep direction. But a lot of times it's, you know, hopefully like me with my kids, like, you know, letting the process occur as well. And I'm learning that more, to not force myself on my kids, you know? And so, I don't know. I get so much out of it, man. I don't know if you have any like direct questions. You can be as specific as you want, mm-hmm. but it's a huge thing in my life. I love it, man.
Could you take us to one of the spiritual or direct experiences of your like, I knew what direction to go in because of this download or this piece of information?
I think it's, I mean, a lot of it's how you frame it, but like, I remember the first time I saw my wife, like, you know, like I had I'd call it a spiritual experience, although it probably was, but where I was like, that's an amazing person. I want to get to know that person more. You know, like,
what was the context?
first day of a class, a psychology class, and I was just like, I saw her, heard her make a comment, and it was just like, get to know that person. Like, that's a person to get to know. I mean, I think that a lot of things too. I mean, right now I'm in the midst of making lots of decisions. And so a lot of it's just clearing the clutter, being open inspiration, lots of time for journaling, and also trusting that whichever way I go, I'll figure it out and that God will help me figure it out. But also like trying to have some discernment about like actually hopefully getting a download of sorts. For me, it's very subtle. It's not usually like, go that way. Write that book. You know, it's just a lot more just in general getting to different levels of attunement so that like the general direction of my choices are at a higher level than they were before.
And in what situations are you most attuned?
I don't know. It's a really good question, man. I try to make sure that always I'm keeping the main thing the main thing. And in different situations that might be different, but like being aware when I'm putting too much emphasis on something that is ultimately a distraction. Mm-hmm. And so just bringing it back, being reminded or getting that inclination, like this doesn't matter, like focus on the stuff that does and just being okay with that. And so a lot of it's just bringing me to like a place of center.
Yeah. I find meditation helps me become more attuned and journaling as well. One question that I've been considering a lot lately is from Patrick O'Shaughnessy, who runs a great podcast, Invest Like the Best. And the question is, how can you be a more perfect instrument?
So why does that stick out to you?
Because it denotes that we are here almost like playing, because we're creative beings. And whatever we choose to do, if you think about you being a creative being, how do you use your creativity as an instrument? And if that is the case, then how do you perfect that? And I think about that as attunement, right? How do you attune your instrument?
Sure.
And it might be one of the most important questions that I've stumbled across in my 3 years of studying questions.
I think that's cool. Yeah, the thing that comes to my mind is Michelangelo, you know, which I wrote about in 10X is Easier Than 2X, and him becoming such a phenomenal artist, but then he transitioned that to painting. And how I look at it is like, what is the instrument? Like, what's the thing you're playing, whether it's him sculpting statues or him painting, but also what's the content? Like, he was painting very beautiful, honestly, like, symbolic images, right? You can be extremely good at a craft, but maybe the content of that may be destructive. Who knows? Right. And so, yeah, I love that. I think that to me, that's like at the heart of the difference between good to great, right. Mm-hmm. Is like being like, and this fits also with what's the 10X that matters. Right. And this is something I'm dealing with right now, which is where do I really want to develop myself and my capabilities, my skills, my mastery, such that it's like what I can do with those can be 100X or 1,000,000X or incomparable to what I can do now. And I think that fits a lot with just knowing that your future self can be massively different, but also deciding the direction of your future self, deciding where you're going to develop mastery, deciding what you're actually going for, you know, and choosing a direction that maybe refines you in a different way. So like what I'm, you know, back to the idea of like the Incerto, like, you know, I'm really like clarifying and getting committed. Like, I'm going to do a multiple set of series, but like, I want to just like go as I want to get as good as I can at what I'm teaching and presenting, which, you know, my future self would look back and be like, man, like I've, you know, like hopefully the version of me now is like a, you know, a child compared to that. But yeah, I think I love your question. And, it makes me just think about what's the valuable thing for you to refine and attune. And what's going to make the difference.
And for you right now, that is what?
For me right now, I mean, certainly parenting. That's teaching me so much. And it teaches me so much on different topics. The other one is what I would call, like, you know, human change. Whether that's, you know, getting connected to your, you know, future self, but also continuously refining your past and learning to let go faster. A lot of it has to do with leadership training. So like my PhD was on transformational leadership, and I'm seeing more and more the power of training leaders. I love doing it, and I'm also seeing that what I can teach them is a game changer. But I want to get better and better at that. And so, yeah, those are some of the things. I mean, I want to be able to understand, teach, and help people in a day, you know, with a tool or with an insight, you know, do what maybe without that would have taken 20 years.
Mm. What I find so fascinating about doing what we do is we're constantly learning about ourselves through the things that we put out. And I think all human beings are in that arena, yeah. But some get exposed to it more than others by virtue of them putting themselves out there more. It's like you do 3 podcast episodes a week, or you write articles, or you write books. It's like someone will comment and be like, well, what I think you're actually trying to say is how I view you based on what you wrote is this. And you're like, damn, that's right. They know me better than I know myself. So I guess the question becomes, other than putting ourselves out there more, how do we get to know ourselves better?
That's a huge question. I think that, yes, putting yourself out there is huge, but also giving yourself time for alone time.
Mm.
Like, I learn a lot about myself by genuine reflection, by journaling, but also by actually having conversations one-on-one with people who I value their input, but also who I know they'll tell me. People like those Tucker Max conversations where he'll give me an outside frame or an outside view of me, and I all listen and be like, dang, man, like that's spot on, and I wasn't really thinking about it that way, you know? So I think, you know, journaling is super helpful, meditation, thinking about it, like, and using that as a quiet space to be really honest. I mean, and not filtering yourself. Don't write for anyone else. Like, if it's in your journal, just freaking say it and just look at it.
Yeah, that's a big thing that I want to point out that people have told me in the past, is that they filter themselves in their own journal. Yeah. And I never understood this.
Yeah, no.
What is that?
I mean, sometimes my orientation to journaling when I first got into it was that I was like writing my history and that like my kids and grandkids would read it and stuff like that. And like I've just totally walked away from that view of journaling. And I'm totally comfortable freaking burning or throwing all my journals away if it needs, or just letting it be and just letting them see a different side, you know? But I think that you get to the – I love, again, the quote, all progress starts by telling the truth.
Mm.
You know, that's an Alcoholics Anonymous quote. I think that's true of just how you feel, what happened, but also where you want to go. All progress starts by telling the truth. Be honest about your future self. But I think just in general, getting more and more transparent, being more open, being less needing to be overly filtered, you know? I mean, yeah, you want to be wise, be thoughtful, but like in my journal, it's just like, just say it. Be as honest as you possibly can with yourself. And if you need to, throw the dang thing away. Burn it away. You know, do it. If that's a factor on your mind, then do something with it. But I think over time you become more and more comfortable with your own ability to transform. And so even if someone reads it, like, okay, that's who I was. Like, let's do something about it. Let's solve it. Like, I'm not defined by that. Let's define it. Let's do something because of it. And I just think, in general, you don't have to be defined by what happened or even what you said, you know? And so I just think just generally that openness helps, but also being open to direct feedback. Not that you have to agree with it. You know, I think when I'm getting any form of feedback, I acknowledge I don't have to agree.
Mm.
But I'll still listen. And maybe I'll process it and maybe it will give me a new lens.
How much of the self-censoring of oneself is because we now know that all of the information that we once said could be used against us?
I'm like the cancel culture and whatnot?
Yeah.
Or just in general?
Or this is the first generation of people who, if you said something 20 years ago, now it has implications for who you are today based on what society could tell you about yourself.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, dude, I can't believe you wrote that in your journal. That's messed up. And now I judge you for that.
Yeah.
In the scenario is what a lot of people are putting in their head.
Yeah, it's tough. You can't control. I mean, certainly you want to be wise, especially if you're in a public domain. And so I do think you get smarter and smarter at when and where you do things. But I still think you have to be the one to control your own narrative. And so, like, no one else has the true context. You know what I mean? No one else knows it. And similar to, like, the story I told at the beginning with my dad, like, I might, on a podcast, talk about how my dad was a drug addict. And my dad might listen and have someone at work be like, dude, I heard your son's interview. My dad has to control the narrative in his own head.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do that. He can have a conversation with me or even with his coworkers and stuff, but he has to control the narrative in his own head and what he does with this. And is this going to wreck him or is this going to be for him?
Mm.
You know? And like, I just think that in general, reaching that place where like you don't have to get so hung up on stuff. Like, I forgot where I heard it. I heard something recently where it's like, you know, you're just going about your business and then you get some phone call with some really bad news, right? It could be anything. Like, you know, X happened. And so it's like, okay, do you now get blown up by that or do you acknowledge it and then just keep moving forward? And like, you know, you can still do something about it. You might need to do something about it, but can you kind of be an observer of it?
Hmm.
Right? Rather than like, so yeah, I just think, you know, just using my dad as the analogy, like it's totally, it's up to him how he lives that reality. Like I love the quote, you don't see the outside world, you see your own reaction to it.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I mean, there might be something I've said in the past that's going to come back and haunt me, you know, but at the end of the day, does it define me or do I define it? What do I do now as a result? You know, how do I approach it? I can use it as an opportunity to explain the differences and where I'm at now and why I've grown and why that's a good thing. And so I just think always having that anti-fragile approach.
What are the affirmations or the things that you repeat to yourself often?
I think that they're going to be situational, you know, like based on what I'm going for in the moment, you know, like, you know, at any point in time, like in the past, it would have been, I'm going to get that six-figure book deal. You know what I mean? Just like thinking about my future self.
Is it in past tense? Is it in present tense? Is it in future tense?
Does
it matter from your perspective?
I don't know if it matters. I mean, I think that it may matter. You know what I mean? I think the main thing is that you're affirming what you want, not what you don't want. Because that's the difference between approach and avoid. Right, when it comes to me parenting, if you're affirming what you don't want, that means you're projecting a future you don't want, and so everything you do is going to be to avoid that. And so I just think that as long as you're affirming what you absolutely want, all progress starts by telling the truth, not being worried about what other people think about that. You know, so just affirm what you absolutely want. Affirm what you absolutely want. If you want to, pray for exactly what you want. And just own it. And over time, I mean, I've seen for myself over time, you do get what you affirm over and over and over again. And, I believe in that. I mean, the things I think about, I know I'm generating. The things I talk about, I know I'm generating. And so just, you know, affirm only that which you most want.
It's really remarkable, right?
How
you could just, you could say something in your head over and over and over again, and it could actually come true. And it often does. Why is that?
Well, it's because it goes back to selective attention. It's what you're focusing on. It's what you're filtering for.
Mm.
You know, and we're always operating in the present based on whatever we're filtering for. And so, yeah, and that's part of why I like the whole 10X idea is just let the future determine the present. Don't let the present determine the future. You know, so most people, they'll take the present and project that off into the future. Whereas for me, it's like, okay, I am going to use imagination. I'm going to think about the future and the one I really want, even if it looks nothing like my present life, and I'm going to focus on that. I'm going to look at it. I'm going to start reverse engineering that. I'm going to filter for that. I'm going to use that as the lens and say, if that's true, then what has to change now? And then be honest with myself. And doesn't mean I have to change it right now, but also just having the empathy for my current self. That's okay. That like I'm still holding on to a lot of things, and I'm obviously not perfectly living to that future. But I really look at it as the past, present, and future all happening right now when it comes to psychology. So when I say I'm thinking about the future, I'm really just using that as a filter for who I'm being. You know, like being is who you are, and whoever you're being is based on, you know, how you're filtering life. And I could be really angry because of how I filter my past, right? And so it's just really about who you're being, and that's based on what you're filtering and how you're filtering it.
Well, you're being an incredible human being who is giving a lot of knowledge and information and wisdom to people. And for that, I'm so, so grateful. I like to end these podcasts with challenges. And a challenge points to the place in your heart you believe someone in the audience or someone listening should take this conversation and actually do something with it. Because you listen to us.
Sure.
But what are you going to actually do with it?
So one of the challenges I've been giving people lately, and myself, is I don't know when you're going to hear this, and so I'm not going to give a certain time frame, but sometime in the next 12, you know, you give your own time frame, no more than 12 months into the future, but it could be as little as 6 or even 3 months. Pursue something that you genuinely believe is impossible. And I'll tell you why. So like we're recording this at the end of September in 2023. So if I'm thinking about where I want to be on January 1st of 2024, I have my anticipated goals, right? Even also just kind of hilariously listening to my old self's goals, which is awesome. But how can I stretch it so far that like I genuinely don't think it's possible, and be comfortable with that? But the reason why you want to do that is so that you do let that goal become the filter. If you do think it's possible, then chances are you're operating from your past self's filter. You're operating from... If you think you know how to do something, then you're operating from past assumptions, past experience, because you know how to do it. But if you're going for something you genuinely don't know how to do, or even don't even know if you could do, then you start to filter very differently. And I've done this. Like, I mean, I've applied this even, you know, in August, my team pursued 2 impossible goals. One of them was a goal that we had for the end of the year, and we just decided, let's just do it this month. And we actually achieved that goal. And when you watch yourself do something that you didn't know was possible and you actually watch, it changes your confidence, right? It changes what you think is now possible. You've got a new frame. The other goal we had, we didn't even scrape the surface of, but what it did by pursuing it and by using it as a filter and saying, okay, if we're really going to go for this by the end of the month, like then we need to start putting these things in place now. It expedited so much of the process that we would have eventually had to get to anyways, getting a new person for this role and doing this and like weeding out. And so I just invite people to make a goal that's impossible. I learned a lot of this from Dr. Alan Bernard, who I referenced a lot of his work in 10X is easier than 2X. He's a dear friend, but he's studied this in the context of business for a long time. And when you start pursuing something that's impossible, you find the few things that really matter, and it allows you to look a lot more critically at your current life and the fact that most of the things you're doing now wouldn't get you to that. And so you can keep that stuff now, or you can start to find the few things that really matter. Call it the 20% using the 80-20 principle. Like you can find those few things, and I'll just say this last thing is like when you change the goal, whatever it is, like it immediately changes how you think about everything. And so like, it's just fun to just play up in that huge world of impossible goals, and then to get committed to it and be, you know, I love the quote, expect everything, but attach to nothing. Mm. And so like, I'm going for impossible goals. We're absolutely committed to them. We're going for them. Some of them we'll achieve, some of them we won't. But to me, it doesn't matter. Like, I'm just learning and growing, and I know in 3 months my life's gonna be totally different. And I know that I'll look back then, and that version of me is gonna turn all of this into incredible fodder for their own future. And so it's all great.
And it is incredible when you actually get the chance to realize something you once thought was impossible. And I am so honored and humbled for this conversation here today. And where should we send people to connect with you further?
Well, I have to ask you a question if I can. Please. And your audience. So what's one thing that you've achieved that maybe your past self, either a year or 2 years ago, would have thought was impossible? And you might not want to say it.
No, I'm very open.
Or even experience, achieved or experienced.
So the crazy thing about me, and maybe I need to dream bigger, is the impossible things that I have on my list that seemingly are impossible.
But they were impossible to your past self, not to your current self. Something that you've experienced or achieved that your past self, maybe it's not that they would, you know, you're a very optimistic guy.
I think God, it would have been very difficult, if not impossible, for me to believe that I could have a relationship with God.
How long ago would that version of you would have believed that would have been difficult?
A year.
So a year ago, months. That version of you would have felt like that's not very likely.
Yeah.
Or even...
I was deep into meditation, and I was deep into stuff like that, but just to like read the Bible and to go to church and to have transformative experiences, to me that was like, I don't know, that seems impossible.
That's amazing. What I'll say to your audience is this. This is something that I think is very interesting, is take your current self, whatever you've achieved, whatever you've experienced, or whatever now is your reality, and go back to at some point when some version of yourself would have thought that was impossible. And so it's a twofold challenge. One is look back and actually acknowledge the things that you've done or achieved or experienced or realized that some version of you would have thought was impossible. But I invite you to not go back too far, because of course if you went back 10 years ago, like of course a lot of the things you've done, you know, do it in the last year. I guarantee you, if you filter for it and if you look for it, there are things that you've done, things that you're experiencing that maybe you've already normalized to yourself, because we adapt so quick, that even a year ago version of you would have just been like, it wouldn't have even been on their radar, or they would have thought that's just like, they wouldn't have seen a path to it. Yeah. They really wouldn't have, they wouldn't have gotten it. But now, like, you've had it, you've experienced it. And so acknowledge and see where you've actually done things your past self would have thought were at least highly unlikely, but let's go with the realm of like, they wouldn't have thought it was possible. Or like, but then actually apply that to your future self. Actually go for something that you just genuinely, like, you almost don't even want to think about it, because it's just like, you're just almost laughing. Like, that's, and actually choose one that you really want and commit to it and start to let that be the filter. So anyways.
I think that's why Matthew McConaughey hates the term unbelievable, because if something is unbelievable and you're witnessing it, how could it be? How could you not believe something you're seeing? And I think a lot of the times we think about a future for ourselves that is unbelievable. It happens, and we're starstruck. We're in awe at ourselves, and that's why I think it's so important, and the exercise is so good to go back, because if you go back, you could see all the ways in which your life is quote unquote unbelievable, impossible.
To your past self.
Correct.
Yeah, and that's actually, if you really study Einstein, relativity is all about one observer against another. Relativity always means you're looking at it from one reference point. They actually call it the inertial reference frame, which is the frame that is kind of, call it stationary. And you're in a different reference frame that's accelerating. And it's from that frame, which I would argue is just your past self, that you can then see the difference. And this one's flying, but only from this perspective. And so it's really good to have that other frame where you can choose it. It's like, and if I went back to myself at the beginning of the year, that's the inertial frame. All right, from that person's self, how does that person look at my current self and what's going on? They probably can't even comprehend it, you know? But it's, so I think it's really cool to do that. Anyways, any last thoughts before I share?
No, I think I'm just really, this conversation is really going to make me think, and one that I'm going to have to journal on and reflect on and really set bigger targets. Oh, one last thing that I wanted to mention that could be a useful exercise for someone is, at the start of this year, I wrote a letter to myself and an email and scheduled it for me to receive the following year. And so on January 1st of 2024, I'll get an email from myself. And it's the only scheduled email I have. So every now and then I'll look at it and be like, that's so funny that I thought about that. But that's one thing that I'm going to challenge people to do is write a letter to yourself 1 year from now, and or 5 years or yep. 10 years.
Sure.
And talk about your current place, but also where you'd like to go. And I think that is very useful. And you mentioned, obviously, Mr. Beast and that example. So,
yeah. So Mr. Beast is a, obviously a character that any psychologist would love to study. And I'm a fan of him. But yeah, he did that. You know, he wrote 4 letters to himself, but he did it in the form of videos speaking to his future self. You can see the first 3. He might have even done more, but ultimately, you know, I came aware of that when his "Hi Me in 5 years" popped up, right? And it was like, what the heck is this? And it was a video of him from 5 years earlier that he had filmed and then scheduled to go live 5 years into the future. And it was him talking to his future self 5 years into the future. And I, you know, went back and found that he had done that other times too. He'd filmed 4 videos that night, 4 or 5, but ultimately he was talking to his future self, and then he would publish, you know, he published it, but he set it to go live at the future time frame. So he spoke to his future self 6 months into the future, set it to go live, set it like a, you know, had a conversation a year into the future. And I actually, in looking at his YouTube channel, like, I really believe that was an inflection point for him, because like the videos really started to change after that. And you could see that he got that emotional conviction and commitment. He was getting committed to his future self. And so I love your exercise. I would say I've done this in different forms. I've done different time capsules or different letters. I think it's a very useful exercise. It's just for you. It's not for anyone else. I mean, Mr. Beast made it public, which is awesome. Totally for it. But yeah, so write a letter to your future self or film a video for your future self. That's awesome. You can do it for, you can even do it for 3 months into the future. Do an impossible goal. Seriously, it's kind of nice to have a short time frame. So maybe with this challenge, you know, you can do the year one, but whenever you hear this, have some short-term impossible goal. And this is between you and your future self. No one else needs to see it. But say what your impossible goal is. Say where you're at. Say what your impossible goal is. Say why you want it. Say what you're going for. And then whenever the time frame comes, look back and watch it, and then just celebrate your past self no matter what happened. The other thing you can do, though, is you can film a video or write a letter as your future self. And this is something I do in my journal very regularly. It's like I'll go 3 years into my future, and I'm pretty dang excited and clear about where I want to be in the future, and I will write the letter as my future self to me today, which obviously me today is the past self to him. And just write down, this is where I'm at. This is my life. This is what I did. These are the big things that I, you know, ultimately committed to. These are the things that I had to let go of. And just mess with it. Again, the past and the future are a draft, but have fun with it. And just, you know, it could be 3 years into the future, it could be a year, it could be those 3 months in the future, writing down what happened. But truly enjoy the playfulness of it, the imagination of it. And it's just, it's between you and yourself, honestly.
Dr. Ben Hardy, you inspire me so much. You inspire me to dream bigger, to be more thoughtful about the ways in which I choose my goals and choose my future. And just by your willingness to continue to improve, it inspires me. So thank you so much for being you. Thank you so much for having that connection to God, for flowing with light, and for being a source of inspiration for at least me, and I know many others listening and watching.
Thanks, man.
Where can we send people to connect with you?
Just BenjaminHardy.com is fine. That's my website. YouTube, Dr. Benjamin Hardy. You can look me up there. I think that's about it, man. Go ahead.
Anything in particular you're trying to plug or you're trying to...
No, I do want people, if they would, to read 10X is Easier Than 2X. Even if you're not an entrepreneur, I just think that that book is such deep psychology. And it just, I think it's my best work yet in terms of public. And so hopefully my next book totally outdoes it. But I mean, certainly other people might like my other books, but for me at least, that's the place to start.
It was interesting going back through your writing and seeing how it improved over time. Going from Medium posts to the different books and seeing even from 2022 to 2023 how the writing did improve. So.
Yeah, I always try to do that. That's that craft that you're talking about, that attunement. You know, just trying to get better at what I do. It's fun.
Yeah. So all your links are down below, your books down below. Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate you.
Of course, man. Thank you.